Ian Bremmer's story starts on a college trip to Russia as a 16-year-old. Yes, Ian was in college as a 16-year-old, where he learned that the world really is a complicated global community.
And then I find myself not only connecting with all of these young people who are, you know, in many ways have the same thoughts and concerns that and aspirations that I did, but were living in a country that was just profoundly beyond imagination.
We talk about that life-changing trip, which started off when Ian accidentally electrocuted himself, and about the world today and how puppets can help us understand that world. We also try to stump him with the world quiz, and it turns out that Ian does know what's going on in Liechtenstein. I'm Andrew Kaufman, and this is The Strategist, presented by the George W. Bush Institute. What happens when you cross the 43rd president, late-night sketch comedy, and compelling conversation? The Strategist, a podcast born from the word strategery, which was coined by SNL and embraced by the George W. Bush administration. We highlight the American spirit of leadership and compassion through thought-provoking conversations. And we're reminded that the most effective leaders are the ones who laugh. Our guest today is Ian Bremmer, founder and president of the Eurasia Group and a real foreign affairs expert. The man has a huge database of knowledge in his head about what's going on around the globe. Ian, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. I've never done strategery before, so this is exciting for me.
It's a real horizon expander, I'd like to think.
Yeah.
Ken Hirsch, the CEO of the Bush Center, is our co-host today. Ken, thanks again for taking the time from your schedule to help us out.
Thank you for having me, and it's always an honor to be here with Ian.
Well, you two have quite have a history, I understand.
Yeah, we met on an airplane about 10 years ago.
We did. Yeah, we were on the way to the mecca of globalist strategery. Davos.
Right.
Yeah. And as a consequence, you know, that's the kind of, it leaves a mark, that kind of a meeting. It really does.
But Ian is one of the best. And I've always been impressed. I read as much as I can that he writes, and listen when he talks. And so, thank you for having the time today to be here. And, we want to talk about what's on your mind, but we also want to talk about you a little bit.
Okay.
We can do that?
Yeah.
Okay. So
I barely do that.
I know.
Like, you talk about me. That's not like, yeah, I'm the analyst, right?
Talk a little bit about how you got to be a current events international affairs junkie.
Oh, a junkie. Well, I mean, I loved reading The Economist when I was a kid. I loved playing.
How'd that do for you?
I loved playing Risk. I didn't tell people, right? It's best not to. I loved playing Risk. That did better for me because my friends were suitably dorky. This was pre Dungeons and Dragons, but same basic cadre of, you know, sort of undersexed, underaged young men. But I'd never traveled anywhere. Right. I mean, like, you know, you bring your kids, I get your Christmas cards every year and they're all over the world and it's fantastic. And you and I get to go everywhere now. But when I was a kid, I went nowhere. I'd never traveled outside the U.S. And so the fact that I felt a little transported out of my background to understand these, you know, pretty exotic, crazy places always for me made me interested. But then, I mean, what really gave me the bug is the first time I ever left the United States was a trip when I was 16 years old in college, because I started early. A professor was leading a trip of students to go to the Soviet Union, 1986. And so never having gone anywhere before, I find myself in the heart of the evil empire, right? And then I find myself not only connecting with all of these young people who are, you know, in many ways have the same thoughts and concerns that and aspirations that I did, but were living in a country that was just profoundly beyond imagination and that none of my friends really understood. And if you watch the media, they didn't really portray it well either. And that made me feel like, no, this is something.
And that was before the wall came down, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, this was before Gorbachev had just come in a few months before, but this was before Perestroika and Glasnost. This was when he first came in. He was talking about anti-alcohol campaign, anti-corruption. I mean, this was still very, very Soviet monolith. It was pretty cool.
And did that make you appreciate political differences, or did it make you appreciate personal differences? How did you What was that reaction like?
It made me appreciate that when we talk about, I mean, the Soviet Union in those days as the evil empire, right? As, I mean, this was Reagan days, and a competitor that had to be smashed and defeated. And then you realize that actually inside the Soviet Union was so much diversity of individual spirit, so much diversity. I mean, not only did I go to Moscow and then Leningrad, but I also went to the former Soviet republics of Georgia and Armenia and Azerbaijan. And they felt then like different countries with completely different nations. And, you know, if you heard as just an average American citizen about the Soviet Union, you'd never sense that there were all these different countries inside it that all had their own national spirit and sense of who they were, historic identity. And certainly a lot of them didn't think of themselves first as foremost as Homo Sovieticus, right? I mean, Soviet man. So yeah, I mean, I would say it was a combination of the personal and the political as experienced through the eyes of a 16-year-old kid that had suddenly been injected into, like, look, in the United States, it's, if you've got people around you take care of you, I mean, you know, we're a very litigious society. There's warning labels on everything. It's hard to really screw yourself up, right? I mean, there are a lot of second chances that you get for most kids growing up in the U.S. Again, that's increasingly not as true as we'd like it to be. And I'm sure we'll talk about that. But in the Soviet Union, right, there are no warning labels on anything. So funny story, I don't think I've ever told anyone this publicly before. My first experience in the Soviet Union, I show up with this massive hotel, the Hotel Russia. It's on Red Square. It's where all the Olympic athletes were being put up during the 1980 Summer Olympics, the ones that we boycotted. And I through the maze to finally get to my room. I'm completely shattered, exhausted from the trip, the jet lag. I'd never experienced like that before in my life again. And I get to the room and there's a little single bed and there is a light fixture that is clamped on to the headboard. And there's no place to turn the light. Instead, that there is there's a wire that apparently has the on-off switch on the wire behind the headboard. So I reach behind the headboard to grab the on-off switch, which, you know, really does violate rule number one in Soviet society, which is never put your hand anywhere you can't see. So here I do this.
Did something bite you?
So I find the switch, and as I go to switch the switch, the plastic had been eaten through. My fingers hit the wiring. I electrocuted myself and passed out in the bed. And the door was still open. I had just brought my suitcase in. Again, it was really dark. So, I mean, that's where one of the other students found me walking through the hallway, saw that I was lying there passed out on my bed from having been electrocuted. And welcome to the Soviet Union. And I mean, you know, the fact is that it's just, there is something to this idea that you should not be protected from all things growing up, right? And this was a real slap in the face of reality for me.
So you were literally shocked by what you saw.
I was literally shocked by what I saw.
You know, speaking of being shocked, one of the things that you, I think that you do such a good job at is putting risk into perspective globally. When you analyze the world, you assemble the pieces, connecting the dots on what's happening, but then start to really illustrate to people how risks are shifting. That's a very quantitative approach to a qualitative science. Talk a little bit about how your mind works when you think about analyzing political risk.
Well, so first of all, when I think about how big a risk is, I think about the scale of the impact. So, I mean, you know, Syrian refugees matter a lot in the Middle East. They matter a fair bit in Europe, particularly Southern Europe. They matter not at all to the United States or Japan or China. That's important. And, you know, I look at the imminence of the risk. You know, in other words, are we talking about something that is really likely to happen in the next week? Or is this something that we really think about in 3 or 5 or 10 years time? Because, you know, we talk about climate change. There's a lot of impact, but there's not as much imminence. And, you know, when you put a discount variable, as Obama did, you know, sort of, you know, around the time of the Paris Accord of 5%, I mean, you know, the impact starts becoming much reduced, right, in your mind. And then, of course, you have the likelihood. And so I do try to think of all three of those things. You have a lot of political scientists get things right in terms of understanding analysis and get things wrong in terms of timing. And for the markets, as you know with your history, Ken, if you get timing wrong, you're gone.
Right. Okay. So now I want to drill down on that for a second. Human beings don't have a great track record when it comes in international relations to being exactly the rational actors. You've talked a lot about accidents, miscalculations, kind of irrational escalations, something that may not be imminent, but then when human beings take over, all of a sudden, you know, emotion gets into it and things escalate and then it becomes imminent.
Well, I guess one point I'd make is, it's a lot easier to predict things that can't happen than things that can. In other words, looking at the political context and the limitations, so many things that people talk about as their stated principles and preferences and policies are things that are inconceivable to implement. So, you know, I think one of the first things you need to do in trying to understand what's happening in the world is say, okay, I know this is what they're saying, but here is the range of the plausible. And that gets you pretty far. I mean, that gets you to why we're going to have a minimum of 3 degrees of climate change, irrespective of what people are saying about, you know, we all have to wear hair shirts and, you know, sort of things are going to be, this is such a disaster. Well, okay, but we're not going to do anything. So let's recognize how that plays out. But you're right that, you know, accidents happen. Big accidents happen. I mean, the Cuban Missile Crisis, right? If you think about that submarine, that we had an aircraft carrier that was dropping depth charges on a Soviet submarine. We thought they had contact with Moscow. They did not. They had autonomy to launch a nuclear torpedo against an American aircraft carrier. The commander of that Soviet sub wanted to do it, as did one of his principal reports, but you needed all three to get it to happen. And one of them said no. And as a consequence, we didn't have a nuclear war.
Right.
Now,
this week, yeah, we almost had an accident in the East China Sea.
That's right.
Between a Russian
and the Americans.
And the Americans.
Right.
And real accident or?
Well, it could have been, the Russians are clearly, so one very interesting thing is that for the first 2 years of the Trump administration, Russian state media was being very careful to criticize the Americans, but never Trump himself. That's now changed. I think the Russians clearly are going to meddle in our election in 2020. It's absolutely not clear to me they prefer the Trump administration. They did in 2016, but I mean, in part, all of the people that were in the tank for the Russians have now either been fired, some of them are in jail. I mean, Carter Page and Papadopoulos and Manafort and Flynn.
And you've pointed out that despite the rhetoric on Trump and whatever collusion, et cetera, the actual policies, things that have actually happened, sanctions are up.
Yep.
We're today, there's a report that we're talking about fortifying Poland more. I mean, there's,
yep,
you know,
weapons for Ukraine.
Yeah, weapons for the Ukraine. So we're not, if you just woke up from a coma and said, what are we doing to Russia? You'd say,
It looks like we're much tougher. Clearly, that is not Trump individually, but it doesn't matter. I mean, the Russians don't care where it comes from. They're completely realpolitik around this stuff. But the point is that in that environment, in an environment where U.S. leadership globally is weaker than it used to be, where our allies are more divided than they used to be, where the Russians are in decline but are really angry and more risk acceptant, and where the Chinese are bigger and are building an alternative, right? The likelihood of accidents goes up. And we have to admit to ourselves, you know, like we still have this nuclear balance with 15,000 warheads around the world, with not great fail-safe mechanisms, where people can make mistakes. And if you really take a second and think about it, it's been a long time since the Cold War, But that still exists.
Right.
It's an obscenity.
Right. So let's talk about that for a second, because in a Cold War world where there's some stability there, you've coined the phrase G0, and that,
which is what?
In your mind, why don't you define
that? No.
Not the puppet show.
You're just going to go on. We got to tell people what it is.
I know. I'm going to have
to. So, Ken, no, you do it. Come on.
No, come on.
You know what a G's are. Come on. You can do it.
Well, we're in a world where the whether it's the G20, the G7, or the G8 don't matter as much anymore on a global consensus building framework. Now it's more of an every man for himself kind of world. And you've coined the phrase G0.
Absolutely.
So in that G0 world, what governs?
In that G0 world, it's not like there isn't leadership, but there's not global leadership. So, I mean, if you go to Mexico or Canada, they know who's in charge. It's us. And we've made that abundantly clear. Like, if they don't do what we want, if the Canadians don't, you know, sort of arrest and get prepared to extradite the daughter of the founder of Huawei, which is going to make the Chinese really unhappy with them, there will be hell to pay. If the Mexicans don't give us the what for on immigration and all the rest, there's going to be hell to pay. In Asia, right, Southeast Asia, for example, right, increasingly East Asia, increasingly Central Asia, the Chinese are absolutely dominant. In Southeast Ukraine, the Russians are pretty dominant, right? The problem you have, of course, is that in the Middle East, there, with the absence of the United States playing the role that we had historically, you got a lot of countries in the region that want to be dominant. And they hate each other.
Right. And so in your mind, are we sorting into these spheres of influence? And then countries like, say, a Philippines that was a traditional ally in our sphere of influence, but now they're stuck in the Chinese sphere of influence. And without our leadership, they have to transition. And then there's the gray areas around the world that are you know, obviously Eastern Europe is a grayer area. Are we in a situation now where these spheres of influence are going to define the predictability about how people are going to act and react, as opposed to thinking about it more globally?
I think that there are three things that are happening. That's one, and that is a world that we have experienced before, and it hasn't gone very well. On top of that, you have the economic implications of the United States and China, where the Chinese are increasingly a dominant power in lots of places that aren't geographically close to them, not an easy sphere, I mean, including a lot of South America, including Eastern Europe. Russia would consider Eastern Europe to be their security sphere. But economically, the Chinese are increasingly dominant there, and that gives them an awful lot of influence to create a Belt and Road Beijing consensus, right, with a lot of leverage. And then you have technology, where there are only two countries that matter, the Americans and the Chinese, and we're building two competing systems. And that feels more Cold War-like. You know, the fight over 5G, the fight over cyber, over data, over the cloud, over AI. So it would be easier to understand if it was purely about, okay, the Americans don't have the same global leadership we did, so now we're going to break into sort of geographic, economic, security spheres. But in reality, it's become a lot more complicated.
Okay, so before we leave G0, how are puppets going to help?
How are puppets not going to help? I mean, you're asking the question wrong.
Okay, so explain to me.
There's nothing where puppets don't help.
So puppets are the answer.
Puppets are clearly the answer. I mean, it amazes me that you can have an environment politically that has become as toxic, as divided, as patently absurd as politics have become in the United States, and we have no puppets. Like, that's just wrong. I mean, we used to have the Muppet Show. You had Spitting Image in the UK. You had Guignol in France.
Well, there used to be puppets in Poland.
Yeah.
And places, but they were a different kind of puppets.
Well, sure. And we have now, we have Puppet Regime. And when I first told which is the only name it could possibly be. And when I first told my staff that we were going to do this, because they said, why? And I said, because no one else is doing it. And the people need it.
So what is Puppet Regime?
Puppet Regime is a whole bunch of Muppet-like puppets, professionally done and puppeteered and voiced, We've got about 40 or 50 of them now. There's a Mohammed bin Salman. There's a Putin. There's a Kim Jong-un. There's a Nancy Pelosi. There's an Ian Bremmer. And of course, there is a Donald J. Trump. And they all have to be both funny and educational. And they're not angry. I mean, my view is you have to make people at least 10% less crazy. You have to make them less, more willing to engage, less wanting to throw their cell phone or a shoe at their television, right? And right now, when you talk to people about politics, when you watch CNN and Fox, it's driving them insane.
Or driving them away.
Frequently, it's not. It's driving them more into only following things that they already think they agree with, which is really horrible because people are demanding so much political content right now. These companies are making a lot of money, a lot of eyeballs, but it's crazy. You guys know that I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I've never been a member of a political party. But I am incredibly interested in the state of the world. And I think that, you know, as an American with a voice, who has a bunch of people that follow me and listen to what I say, and I've got some resources now, it would be wrong for me to not do something to try to help people be less crazy.
So, Ian, you are really one of the country's best geopolitical thinkers, and you have been active in publishing that we're in a geopolitical recession. Which is, for people who think in terms of recession.
You're going right from puppets in a
I'm going to puppets. I'm going from puppets to recession.
Is there a kind of narrative? Is there a through point here?
That no, I just thought it was time to change.
Okay, fine.
He was bored of puppets. Yeah.
Okay. If people could see the puppets, they would not be bored. But okay, let's do
no,
that.
No, I'm not fine. Bored by your puppets. I like
that's
the puppets.
Okay,
but I want to talk about geopolitical recession.
Fine, geopolitical recession. We'll do
while
it.
We're still having time. Mm-hmm. But we still have time. So when people think of recession, if it's an economic recession, then we have remedial action. We have a Federal Reserve that can lower interest rates or quantitative easing. We can have fiscal stimulus, et cetera. Geopolitical recession in a G0 world, what do we do?
One is for those people, institutions, countries that recognize it, they need to do everything they can to backstop our existing institutions so they don't fall apart while we're in the process of figuring out what the new world order is going to be. Because unlike an economic recession, they happen fairly quickly. They have, you know, relatively short cycles. Geopolitical recessions have long cycles. It takes a long time for a global order to unwind. That is what is now happening. We are in this interregnum before the next system comes together. That's the geopolitical recession. It's going to take at least 5 years, 10 years, right?
And we don't live in a world where there's only one winner. We can live in a world where it's not a zero-sum game. And I think that's the big difference sometimes within the Putin mindset and the American mindset at times.
Yes. And the question is, where's the Chinese mindset? And where's really the American mindset? Do we believe that it has to be our way or the highway? Historically speaking, the Americans do not believe that we can learn an awful lot from other countries. They think we're the ones that like are doing the teaching. I worry about that. It is clear to me that if you talk about trade, even though we talk about tariffs a lot these days, trade is win-win. Mm-hmm. The global economy is largely win-win. We want the only thing worse than China, you know, sort of succeeding is China failing, right? Because we need a robust China. They need a robust United States, right? We get that. But then when you talk about, you know, the technology situation, where we're saying we don't want Huawei and they don't let in Amazon or Facebook or Google. They're creating a completely different system. That is zero sum.
So why does the 5G thing matter? Like to 4G, 5G, I'm downloading YouTube videos at the same speed. Why does that matter on a global perspective?
It is true that 5G will allow you to download things 100 times faster. So there'll be what they call ultra low latency. So you won't have to think about that. And that'll make your smartphone much more powerful, run much cooler apps. People spend a lot of time on those. If the Chinese are the ones aggregating the data from your individual apps, that matters. But that's not why 5G matters. Why 5G matters is because 5G is what actually underpins the backbone of anything with a chip in it. So that also includes your car, your refrigerator, your heating system, electricity, you know, smart cities. And so as a consequence, we're talking about, you know, who is going to control the big data, the surveillance, and the monetization thereof, and the nudging of popular behavior
and
thereof.
And the travel between and the communication with.
Absolutely. And so, I mean, I have to say, and this is a pretty controversial thing for me to say, it's quite possible that the right American strategy is to destroy Huawei, because we really don't want two systems. But I think that if that is the case, it's also true that it's the right American strategy to do that, not by ourselves, but with our allies, with the Europeans, with the Japanese, with the Canadians, and that we're not doing.
So in a technology cold war, is that possible?
It is absolutely possible.
If it's wouldn't they just recreate?
Yes, but if they recreate, but we are with all of the most important advanced economies, then you have something that feels equivalent to what the Trans-Pacific Partnership would have been, or the World Trade Organization, which is the Chinese ultimately are not trying to destroy us.
But to, so now to take you back to your in a G zero world, yep. to get an agreement by everyone else but China on what to do with Huawei. Mm-hmm. is going to be quite difficult when all of our institutions are so weak.
You're right.
Or weakening.
It's a lot harder to get a proactive multilateral agreement. On the other hand, the United States has unilaterally withdrawn from the Iranian nuclear deal. Everyone disagreed with that decision. Everyone, our allies and the Chinese and the Russians. And yet, all of those countries have now either cut off or dramatically reduced the energy that they are purchasing from the Iranians. And the reason for that is because we put major sanctions on them and said, we're not going to let you bank with us if you actually don't uphold our sanctions. So unilateralism does not work well with carrots,
but I think
it works well with sticks if you've got the power.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. I think first we need to have consensus on how to spell Huawei, make sure people could spell
it. I can do that for you. It is H.
U-A.
W.
AI?
EI.
Ah, I knew I'd be the one.
Oh.
Well, as long as we're talking quizzes, we threatened before, when we were talking before, that we would try and stump you with this, a little spin the globe game, where I was saying in our intro that you have this amazing database of world affairs. And so we thought we'd throw a few countries at you, give us a couple sentences on what their current state of affairs is, maybe what a challenge is. And we'll see if we can find one that you got nothing on.
Give him a hard one.
You want to start with something hard?
Don't give him a softball.
Let's start with Montenegro.
Montenegro. Jesus, you are starting high. probably the most interesting headline with Montenegro, because they are a recent inductee into NATO, is when Trump, during the last NATO summit of the heads of state, went in and literally pushed aside the Montenegrin prime minister who was standing in front of him so that Trump could get a better shot in the photograph. And after he did that, he sort of pulled down his blazer and looked very pleased with himself. Montenegro is, I mean, it's kind of funny. The Russians have been deeply unhappy with Montenegro joining NATO. There was a big investigation into the Russians being involved potentially in an assassination attempt in Montenegro, and there have been some Russian spies that have been caught and arrested, and that's also pretty big. And again, when you talk about the Balkans, you talk about Serbia, right, and these places where the Russians have a lot of influence, they're pretty active, but the Americans and the Europeans were very interested in expanding NATO, expanding the EU, and that's played out.
Ken, what are you throwing at him?
Burma, Myanmar.
First of all, most famous person from Myanmar, Aung San Suu Kyi, who received a Nobel Peace Prize for her work, and yet has very much been on the side of the military regime, especially when it comes to nationalism and some pretty deplorable treatment of ethnic minorities, some of whom have been on the receiving end of what you could define as a genocide, certainly ethnic cleansing within Myanmar. So she's been seriously tarnished. Myanmar has probably their best relationship is with Thailand. They trust the Thais as sort of older brothers. They're doing a lot of investment across the border there, building infrastructure. The Chinese, of course, are economically dominant in Myanmar, and it's with a heavy hand. And that's the United States is not playing much of a role.
At Bush Center, we have a leadership program for young leaders in Burma as a country that's trying to move from military to civilian rule and working on with young people, young leaders there in the education space and the healthcare and the NGOs and trying to do the best we can. Last one.
How about the mighty country of Liechtenstein?
Liechtenstein, capital Vaduz, V-A-D-U-S-Z. They have no,
now you're showing off.
No standing army, to the best of my knowledge. I remember when the Swiss actually inadvertently invaded Liechtenstein. I think this was a couple of
that
years
happened.
Ago. It happened.
They got lost. They took a turn left.
Exactly. But there wasn't much of an incident. No, the most interesting thing about Liechtenstein recently is that they joined Belt and Road when Xi Jinping went to Europe. And the big story was Italy and the Italian government was, you know, first G7 economy to join because the Chinese have promised to rebuild the port of Trieste and do a lot of infrastructure. The Americans specifically said, don't join Belt and Road, but we're not offering to write any checks. Mighty Liechtenstein, I mean, which is, you know, effectively just like an entrepot for, you know, sort of fast and questionable cash, but it's one more place in Europe and is, you know, as a principality with the vote, useful for the Chinese to say we've got one more head of state this year at the Belt and Road Forum, which the acronym is BARF, which is why they never use it. Someone needs to start talking about that. They had 39 heads of state, which I think is more than Davos
did this year.
I was invited to go, but not to speak. And next year, I'm going to try to make it because I think it's a pretty big deal. We sent David Gordon, who works with us, and he had a fantastic time, came back with great stuff. But the point is that, you know, they're trying to collect all these heads of state to show that the most important meeting in the world within 5 years is not going to be the United Nations General Assembly in New York, but is going to be the annual Belt and Road Summit. And all belts and all roads lead to Beijing. And that's why Liechtenstein was worth a Xi Jinping meeting. Kind of interesting.
Well, we've got to get Ian and Ken off to their next appointment. If you enjoy this, make sure you read a few of Ian's many books, among them Us Versus Them, The Failure of Globalism, Superpower, Three Choices for America's Role in the World, and Every Nation for Itself, Winners and Losers in a G-Zero World, which we talked a little bit about here today. Ian, thanks so much for doing this and for joining us tonight at the Highland Capital Management Lecture. We really appreciate the time that you're spending.
Great to be on Strategery with you.
We will strategize more in the future because we have
should.
A lot more to cover.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Ian.
If you enjoyed today's episode and would like to help us spread the word about The Strategist, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all the major listening apps. If you're tuning in on a smartphone, tap or swipe over the cover art. You'll find episode notes with helpful information and details you may have missed. The Strategist was produced by Ioana Pappas at the George W. Bush Institute in Dallas, Texas. Thank you for listening.